From NPR News in Washington, I'm Anne Bozell. India's Prime Minister and Pakistan's President are holding the first formal talks between their two countries in more than 2 years. NPR's Michael Sullivan reports from Agra, India.
India's Prime Minister Vajpayee and Pakistan's President Musharraf today held a one-on-one meeting that lasted more than an hour and a half, far longer than had been expected. An Indian Foreign Ministry spokesperson today described the talks as cordial, frank, and constructive, a description echoed by a spokesman from the Pakistani side. Prime Minister Vajpayee has also accepted an invitation from General Musharraf to visit Pakistan, though no date for that meeting was announced. Indian officials say the two men discussed the disputed region of Kashmir, reducing the risk of nuclear war, and what India calls Pakistan's support of cross-border terrorism in Kashmir. The two leaders are meeting again this evening and are expected to hold a final round of talks tomorrow. Michael Sullivan, NPR News, Agra.
Israeli Foreign Minister Shimon Peres has assured Arabs that Israel is not planning to target Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat or launch a major military assault on Palestinian territories. Israeli media had reported last week on contingency plans for such actions. Peres met with Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak today in Cairo and then talked one-on-one with Arafat. The director of the Pentagon's missile defense program says it will be a few weeks before researchers can evaluate last night's missile test, but Air Force Lieutenant General Ronald Kadish says they do know that the interceptor hit its target, a mock nuclear warhead. The successful test gives a boost to President Bush's plans for a national missile defense system, plans likely to come under discussion in Moscow, where Chinese President Jiang Zemin is holding a three-day summit with President Vladimir Putin. NPR's Mike Schuster reports from Moscow.
Both Presidents Putin and Jiang are firmly opposed to the Bush administration's pursuit of national missile defense, and that is one of the main items on their agenda. Last night, the United States carried out a successful test shot of current anti-ballistic missile technology. The Bush administration says it will speed up testing of a missile defense shield. The Russians say that threatens the whole framework of international arms control agreements. While Jiang is in Moscow, he and President Putin are expected to sign a treaty of friendship and cooperation. Some fear it is the prelude to an anti-American alliance, but both presidents deny that, saying they want good relations with the United States. The treaty is believed to include provisions for closer military cooperation. China already is Russia's most important customer for advanced military equipment. Russia is also seeking greater Chinese investment in the impoverished Russian Far East. Mike Schuster, NPR News, Moscow.
Torrential rains have been battering South Korea, triggering landslides and flooding. Officials say at least 33 people have been killed and 14 are missing. This is NPR News from Washington. A major construction job in outer space. The crew of the Shuttle Atlantis and the Alpha Space Station have installed a $164 million passageway for spacewalkers on the space station. Two members of the shuttle crew shepherded the installation from outside during a six-hour spacewalk. It's one of three planned for this mission. Rescuers have not been able to help an injured whale swimming off the coast of Massachusetts. They've been trying to sedate the whale so they can remove fishing line that's tangled in its jaw, but it continues to evade them. From member station WCAI, Dan Triddle reports.
For more than a month, the North American right whale has been swimming some 85 miles east of Provincetown with thick fishing rope stuck in its jaw. Infection has caused the whale to turn a white, sickly color, and scientists have been concerned the 50-ton animal will die without help. But three separate attempts to sedate the whale and slow it down to remove the rope have been unsuccessful. Yesterday, rescuers worked for 7 hours in near-perfect sea conditions and even tried lassoing the whale before giving up. Scientists were able to collect more biopsies to see just how ill the whale is. The rescue team is scheduled to meet tomorrow to decide if another attempt will be made. This whale is one of some 300 left in the world. For NPR News, I'm Dan Tridle in Woods Hole, Massachusetts.
Fire crews say they're making some progress against wildfires burning around Oregon. They say they could contain several large fires within the next 24 hours, including a 21,000-acre blaze. High winds are still posing a problem, but the temperatures have cooled and some light rain is in the forecast. I'm Anne Bozell, NPR News in Washington.
Support for National Public Radio comes from the Ford Foundation, a resource for people and institutions worldwide, and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. This week, broadcasters were out in force on Capitol Hill, lobbying against a law that would require stations to offer politicians lower prices for campaign ads. The provision was passed by the Senate in March as part of the controversial McCain-Feingold legislation. But when the campaign finance bill was stalled in the House of Representatives on a procedural vote this past week, the ad pricing measure attached to the bill was stalled with it. Paul Taylor is the executive director of the Alliance for Better Campaigns, the election reform advocacy group leading the charge to get the provision passed. Paul Taylor, welcome back to On the Media.
Good to be here.
Well, let's lay out the situation. As the existing law stands, broadcasters may charge candidates only the lowest rate that any advertiser commands for political advertising, except.
Except what's happened in the last decade or so is that the incredible torrent of money that's rushed into the political system, the so-called soft money that this bill is supposed to outlaw, has created a classic demand spike. And we tracked this last fall. We looked at 10 stations around the country. Brigham Young University looked at stations in 17 different cities around the country. And we both found the same phenomena. The Brigham Young study found that from the end of July through the end of October, the heart of the campaign season, political ad rates on local television stations tripled. Now, candidates got a slight discount off of tripling. But the idea that this represents a discount, is over the edge. So this law would be designed to close that loophole and say candidates get the same low rates that stations give their high-volume advertisers throughout the course of the year.
And the reason the political advertisers are subject to this tripling of rates is that the lowest rate only applies to advertising that you book far in advance. But if it's the end of the election and supply and demand rules take over, stations then are allowed to supply whatever the market will bear.
That's right. There's also another peculiarity which has to do with the classes in which political advertising is sold, whether it's preemptible or not. Nike or McDonald's will buy in bulk. They'll buy for a month or a quarter. They want to hit certain demographics, and they say to the stations, it doesn't really matter to us if it runs at 6 o'clock on a Thursday or 7 o'clock on a Saturday, as long as we're hitting the targets we want. Candidates want to buy what's called non-preemptible time that can't be bumped, and that tends to be the most expensive time. So they're forced to pay these premiums. And again, this law would close that loophole as well.
Simply put, the low rates go to people willing to fly standby, but the politicians want guaranteed reservations.
That is correct.
Now, tell me what the Alliance for Better Campaigns' interest is in this issue.
Candidates and interest groups and parties spent about $1 billion on political ads on television last year. $1 billion, that's a five-fold increase even after adjusting for inflation over what they spent just 20 years ago. It's by far the largest expense item in modern politics. It is the engine more than anything else that drives the money chase. So one interest is simply to bring that under control and to do something. You're not going to eliminate the cost of communication. Communication costs money. But to do something to at least reduce it.
All right. Now, the broader campaign finance bill is virtually dead, at least for the moment. Is there any chance that this particular measure will be unbundled from the larger bill and voted on by the Congress?
Very little chance, because frankly, the broadcast lobby is very powerful. And if you had an up or down vote on this measure and this measure alone, the odds are the broadcast lobby could kill it. It got in the McCain-Feingold bill earlier this year, 3 months ago, with a very strong vote, and then it was inserted into the House bill as well. The broadcasters spent the last month trying to rip it out of the bill. They were not successful. So had this bill come to a vote last week, it would have had this in it. But I think its best chance of going forward is as part of more comprehensive reform.
In exchange for their broadcast licenses, television and radio stations have some sort of civic responsibilities. I don't know how explicit they are. Is there any chance that Congress will someday interpret those civic responsibilities to mean you have to give away free broadcast time to political candidates?
Well, this bill, this halfway measure that didn't quite make it to the floor the other day, at least is a step in that direction by at least reducing the cost. Part of the problem here is you have, in addition to the economic clout of a very important industry, you also have the self-interest of members of Congress. Now, on the surface, the self-interest would seem to be, sure, they want lower-priced ads. Who doesn't want to get things for less money? But the truth of the matter is a lot of members of Congress say to themselves, you know, the expensive politics, the high-dollar ads, are actually pretty good for me. Because you know what? It's going to cost me more money, but so will it cost my challenger more money. And I do better. I, a member of Congress already in, do better raising money, and I do better in a high-dollar environment.
The fortress of incumbency.
Exactly. This is a tough hill to climb, no question.
Very well. Paul Taylor, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Paul Taylor is the executive director for the Alliance for Better Campaigns.
Years ago this summer, we experienced what is arguably the greatest press leak in history. Certainly it was the longest, the 7,000-page Pentagon Papers. The papers revealed a government struggling to make the Vietnam War palatable to an increasingly hostile American public. It shows government officials, especially President Johnson, ignoring and misrepresenting the facts and violating their promises, lying to the public and lying to each other. One of those officials was Daniel Ellsberg, who decided to let that history out, first through Congress, then on the networks, and finally, successfully, in the New York Times, followed closely by the Washington Post. The Nixon administration retaliated. The president's famous plumbers burgled Ellsberg's psychiatrist's office and reportedly tried to attack him at a demonstration. He was pursued as a spy and finally surrendered to the FBI under the Espionage Act. The newspapers, and there were many of them, who published parts of the Pentagon Papers faced legal penalties themselves. But journalist Neil Sheehan at the New York Times, who first accepted the papers, set the standard for courage, followed by the rest of the American press. The courts ultimately lifted the injunctions that had been slapped on the newspapers and acquitted Ellsberg. That's the quick history. Daniel Ellsberg, take us back to the moment you made the decision to bring the Pentagon Papers to the press.
I'd been trying to get them out through congressional hearings and was promised several times by various senators or congressmen that they would move ahead. But each time they backed off for fear of the retaliation by the executive branch. And finally, I decided the only way to do it was to go directly to the newspapers.
Neil Sheehan said that it was a relatively simple decision at the time. We have a brief clip of him in a 1971 interview with CBS, and let's play that.
In terms of what we were able to obtain, it can be freely used because no real military security question is concerned or diplomatic security. What really is at stake is the question of enlightening the public about one of the most traumatic experiences the country's ever had. And I made a decision, personal decision, that this belonged in the public domain. It was public property. It's public history. It was paid for by the people of this country with 50,000 lives and nearly $100 billion, and that they had a right to know this information.
He said it wasn't a complicated decision because he was talking about history, not active military actions. But it wasn't so simple. At least you didn't find it was simple. You took it to the networks as well, and they all turned you down.
The TV stations, the NBC, ABC, CBS. CBS took the longest to decide no. The others were quite quick. They took a couple days, actually, to decide that they didn't want to fight on this one. And that's why I gave the interview to Cronkite, by the way. I felt that they'd behaved more respectably in that respect than the other networks.
And we can play a brief clip of that famous 30-year-old interview.
I've enjoyed reading the papers the last week. I've been reading the truth about the war in the public press, and it's like breathing clean air.
I remember very well the circumstances of that. That was in a private home in Cambridge, Massachusetts. I can say that now. The FBI was searching all over the country, to some extent the world, for me at that time. They said it was the biggest FBI manhunt since the Lindbergh kidnapping when I made that that interview with Walter Cronkite.
How would you gauge the courage of the press pre-Pentagon Papers and post-Pentagon Papers?
Well, courage is contagious. 19 papers faced prosecution one after the other. As one injunction went out, another one took up that flag and carried it forward. That was courage. They were helped by the fact that the Times had and the Post had unusual courage in being the first to do that. And having once had that experience, I think a generation of journalists grew up with a good deal of pride in saying, we did our job, we have the guts to do this, and we can do it again. And that was a very good precedent.
What about the impact of the papers on government officials?
Well, I think nothing you can do can keep men in office from trying to hide their mistakes, their bad predictions, their crimes. When I say that, it's not from inside knowledge currently. It's from my experience in the government when I was surrounded by intelligent, conscientious, patriotic people who knew from month to month and year to year that their government, Republican or Democrat, was deceiving the public terribly about the information it had and the expert opinions it was getting. And those people, I among them, kept their mouths shut far too long.
But as you know all too well, leakers go to trial for what they do, as you did.
No, I was the first. Leakers don't go to trial. They're threatened with trial. I and all the others had been told that we would be breaking a law, and I assumed that was true. But it wasn't until last October that any Congress had ever actually passed such a law. And if President Clinton hadn't vetoed it, we would now have a law that we've never had before, and then you would see a lot of prosecutions.
The law that was passed and then vetoed by Clinton was an Official Secrets Act, so to speak?
They didn't give it that title, I think. It was part of the Intelligence Authorization Act. And it gives criminal sanctions, prison terms, and fines for any official or an ex-official who has held a security clearance and has had access to classified information, giving that information to unauthorized people.
This act would have criminalized what you did with the Pentagon Papers?
It would have clearly criminalized. I would have been certainly guilty of that. Now, remember, they're always giving classified information to newspapermen that they want out. It's the truly unauthorized ones that this is meant to get.
And that effort to pass that act that was vetoed by Clinton, is it still dead?
Not at all. If the Senate was still in Republican hands, I think we'd have to expect that it would go up to President Bush for signature and that he would not veto it. If that is signed, comes back, and it will come back, well, whether it's signed, whether it passes or not is another question, then there will be a number of prosecutions. There won't be just two. There'll be two in the next month, probably. They already have their eyes, I think, on the Washington Times, for example. Act is almost dedicated to getting them.
Well, Daniel Ellsberg, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Daniel Ellsberg, political analyst, former government official, and the man who committed the renowned unauthorized disclosure of the Pentagon Papers.
Good. That sounded good.
Coming up, Court TV is 10 this month, but courts have enthralled viewers practically forever. Also, the passionate courtroom chronicles of Dominic Dunn.
This is On the Media from National Public Radio.
We're back with On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. When the reality TV show Survivor exploded last summer, there was talk it would transform the viewing habits of a nation, possibly forever. But the home of reality television is actually on cable. It's Court TV, and it turns 10 years old this month. Despite the critics' initial predictions of failure, the cable channel founded by media impresario Steve Brill has expanded from the measly 6 million subscribers it had back in 1991 to 40 million today. Court TV promised gavel-to-gavel coverage and delivered on it almost immediately with the coverage of the rape trial of William Kennedy Smith. The public was transfixed.
He tackled me. And I was on the ground, and he was on top of me. He raped me.
The issue here is I'm innocent. And how do you defend yourself from somebody who says the word rape.
After that, the deluge. Jeffrey Dahmer, Jack Kevorkian, Rodney King, Lorena Bobbitt, Tanya Harding, and, of course, the Menendez brothers. If Steve Brill imagined a niche appeal, the so-called C-SPAN for legal junkies, the trial of O.J. Simpson beginning in 1994 trashed that. Millions tuned in every day. Defense and prosecution lawyers Johnny Cochran and Marcia Clark became overnight stars. Even the presiding Judge Ito was tabloid fodder.
Don't be part of this continuing cover-up. Do the right thing, remembering that if it doesn't fit, you must acquit.
To date, Court TV has televised more than 730 trials and provided more than 28,000 hours of courtroom trial coverage. With me to talk about the last 10 years of courtroom viewing is Court TV CEO Henry Schleif. Mr. Schleif, what effect did the O.J. trial have on the fortunes of Court TV?
You know, I think it was a two-edged sword because it did bring even further prominence, popularity, ratings to Court TV. On the other hand, I think, frankly, the network was a little bit condemned as a result of a verdict that most people felt was incorrect.
You took some of the fallout for the O.J. verdict?
Yeah, I think a lot of people felt that Court TV was somehow associated with some of the circus-like atmosphere that prevailed during that trial. I mean, demonstrably, our ratings fell off after O.J. Was that purely due to the prominence of that trial and the lack of anything to rival it since? I think there's some of that, but I think there's some aspect of the prior qualities to it also.
Well, let's talk about that for a moment. Such notable defense lawyers as Jerry Spence,
yeah,
very flamboyant Texas defense lawyer,
mm-hmm,
has said that the presence of cameras in the courtroom changes the dynamic of a trial for the worse.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think about that?
I think that to see the process unfold serves a greater good to society than anything else. I think all in, will you have perhaps on occasion counsel or testimony that panders to a camera? I think the more and more we have cameras now, it's been 10 years, I think that's the exception. I think, in fact, the majority of the practicing bar and the majority of the judiciary, and indeed the far majority of states, I think it's something like 45, 47 states, now allow cameras in the courtroom.
Do you think people are watching Court TV to immerse themselves in these issues, or do you think they're just digging the dirt?
I think we have a portion of our viewers who enjoy the pure information that you can get from watching the process unfold. I think we have viewers who are in this looking at the titillation, if you will, that comes from a more prominent or high-profile trial. They look at these as little soap operas in many cases. Sometimes they love or hate a participant or the judge or a witness or the defendant. We offer a lot. It depends upon the viewer as to what one takes away.
One of the premises for Court TV is for viewers to have a better understanding of what happens in the criminal justice system.
Right.
Now comes, in the last few years, the drama shows, which, while they're probably more verisimilitudinous than they used to be, NYPD Blue and Homicide, still dramatically contract all of the events around a criminal case, let's just say to the point of distortion. Isn't that kind of a paradox?
Is there a paradox? No, I don't think so at all, quite honestly, Bob. I think you're reading the world of crime and justice too narrowly to say that there's not room for one other aspect or other aspects, I think is too narrow a vision. People have an endless fascination with all aspects of the law.
If the numbers for NYPD Blue and whatever drama programs you're running on the Court TV network really begin to move the needle and the live courtroom stuff continues to contract, can you foresee a day when Court TV has very little court reality and a whole lot of court drama?
Courts and court coverage and trial coverage is so integral to our brand that, you know, we may look for ways to do it better or differently, but I think it is absolutely indispensable to Court TV's history and to our future.
Carla Del Ponte and Slobodan Milosevic.
Yeah.
They're going to play in Peoria?
I think regardless of the number of vowels in someone's name or where they come from, trials are really fundamentally stories of human emotion, of human interest, of conflict. So, yeah, I think what you'll see is that we'll do them in a way that I think our viewers in Peoria will be able to relate to them.
Well, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Bob.
Henry Schleif is the chairman and chief executive officer of the Court TV Network, celebrating its 10th anniversary.
Court TV may have marked its 10th anniversary on the air this week, but as Alicia Zuckerman reports, courtrooms have been riveting TV audiences for decades.
Perry Mason first emerged in the pages of nearly 90 paperbacks by Earl Stanley Gardner in the 1930s, and then on a popular radio series. But in 1957, it was the actor Raymond Burr who personified the Perry Mason that lingers today. Ron Simon is the television curator at the Museum of Television and Radio in New York City.
We always go back to that one looming figure of Raymond Burr in television. He created the lawyer. There was something about the incarnation of the lawyer seen on a regular basis that created, in the public opinion, what a lawyer was like.
After Perry Mason, courtroom shows proliferated, ranging in tone from The Defenders to Night Court to L.A. Law. Simon sees that last show as a turning point.
The thing that certainly that Stephen Bochco and David Kelly brought to the legal genre is that the personal life of the L.A. Law character, or Ally McBeal, are as important as the legal cases. In many ways, the craziness that is reflected in the private life erupts in the craziness of the court system, this total confusion of private and public realms.
In fact, the trials on Kelly's The Practice deal largely with the lawyer's personal issues. And in this scene from his show, Ally McBeal, law partners and best friends John Cage and Richard Fish are going to couples therapy to resolve their issues.
That's my problem, is that he always gets to go first. His needs are always prioritized over those of other people. And the horror of that is compounded when you consider that the center of his very being is nothing but sex and money. Sex and money, sex and money.
In the criminal justice system, the people are represented by two separate yet equally important groups, the police who investigate crime and the district attorneys who prosecute the offenders. These are their stories.
Law and Order, which wrapped up its 11th season this spring, isn't character-driven. The case is the star. Executive producer Jeffrey Hayes.
The first show we did was the Mayflower Madam show, which we called By Hook or By Crook. And then the second show we did was the Bernie Goetz story, which we called Subterranean Homeboy Blues. Ripped from the headline sounds easy. What's hard is to make it dramatically interesting once you get past the crime, once you get into the prosecution.
2 years ago, creator Dick Wolf launched a spin-off series, Law & Order Special Victims Unit. Next season, Law & Order Criminal Intent will join the primetime lineup, and the original show was recently renewed through May 2005. Hayes explains what he thinks makes the show so successful.
In our courtroom scenes, if you look, we do a lot of cutaways to the victim's relatives. A lot of times we'll stop in the middle of a trial and go to the judge's chambers or do a couple of scenes with the jury out. But to me, all that's part of the courtroom drama aspect of it.
Mr. Robinette will ask you to feel sorry for Jenny Mays. That's all right. You can feel sorry for her. But don't forget that there's a dead man here. And don't forget Alex Corbin was abducted by the woman who got him addicted to crack in her womb.
If fictionalized court shows came from Perry Mason, what's the origin of reality court shows? Ron Simon has an answer.
The interesting thing is that reality courtroom drama was also with television from the beginning. If you consider the Army McCarthy hearings, an extended drama in the 50s, then you can see that television was dealing with real-life situations almost from the beginning. There was something intriguing about the courtroom situation.
Let us not assassinate this lad further, Senator.
Let's
You've done enough. Have you no sense of decency, sir? At long last, have you left no sense of decency?
Mm-hmm. Are you not following what I'm saying to you? Is it not piercing through?
If somebody you feel is trying to control your life, you don't put them in a situation where they can do that.
Where courtroom dramas have historically focused on the lawyer, reality shows set the judge at center stage. Today, there are around 10 of these shows that emulate small claims court. Many of them feature some street-smart judge, like Judge Judy, who impart their wisdom with a sharp tongue. 20 years ago, there was just one, the People's Court. When Judge Wapner went on the air in 1981, he generally handled the People's Court with sobriety and respect. Nowadays, TV courtrooms need to up the ante to pull in viewers. Again, curator Ron Simon.
And the archetypal silent judge, who listens and then reacts, is really not someone who plays that well on television. You need someone who motivates the action.
Now on its fourth judge, Marilyn Millian, the People's Court has taken on characteristics of its high-intensity imitators.
We're done, and now's the part where the, this is my favorite part. This is the part where the judge rules and no one interrupts her.
Stu Billett, the show's creator and producer, says that all these shows are sort of interchangeable, but it doesn't matter because the public's appetite for them is insatiable.
They're the soup du jour. The only difference, really, is the judge. Like game shows, back in the 60s and 70s, there were 35 game shows on the air.
Now millions of people are watching the justice system play out on the small screen.
It's a problem because these people then go to sit on juries, and they have some tendency to think they know more than they do.
First Amendment lawyer Floyd Abrams.
People, for example, in criminal cases want to know where the fingerprints are, what the DNA is, when the police don't always get fingerprints and they don't always take DNA sampling.
Abrams still applauds the notion of court shows, both fiction and reality. In fact, he's been an advocate, literally, for cameras in the real-life courtroom.
I had a judge who told me once that because I represented court TV and a successful effort to get television into the O.J. case, that I was personally responsible for the decline and fall of the legal system.
But few people complained about the Army-McCarthy broadcasts undermining the legal system. Most thought it was good for democracy. It turns out what was good for democracy may even be better for ratings. For On the Media in New York, I'm Alicia Zuckerman.
Writer Dominic Dunne came to his vocation by a strange and terrible route. His career as a Hollywood producer had fizzled, as he would be the first to tell you. Life was not so great, and then it got incomparably worse. His daughter Dominique was attacked by her former boyfriend, left in a vegetative state until her shattered parents took her off life support. Dunne took notes at the ex-boyfriend's trial, an apparent travesty of justice, and wrote about it for the magazine Vanity Fair. He's just published a collection of 2 decades of Vanity Fair articles featuring such celebrity defendants as Klaus von Bülow and, of course, O.J. Simpson and the Menendez brothers. It was that first terrible trial that launched Dunne, in his 50s, on his career as a courtroom chronicler. But he's never felt bound by the standard rules of journalism.
I was so horrified at what I saw in that courtroom that I thought, I could write about this. And I did write about it. And I wrote very personal things about it, about the judge, about the lawyers. And indeed, it was a different way to cover a trial than is normally journalistically covered.
And how would you characterize those differences?
Well, I characterize the differences because I also write about the gossip of a trial. I write about the judge who presided in the trial of the man who killed my daughter. And he was very concerned with his image. And a photographer from People magazine was there in the courtroom. And he called that man back into his chambers. And the man thought he was going to be asked to leave the courtroom. And instead, the judge tried on several pair of glasses for the photographer to tell him which pair he looked best in. Now, I found that important information. It had nothing to do with the trial, but everything to do with the judge.
The way that you paint a portrait of the characters who people those courtrooms, the way that you present their backstories, makes for absolutely riveting reading. But it could be argued that some things get left out. For instance, in the trial, when you said that Burton Katz's instructions to the jury were confusing, but you didn't write what those instructions were in order to let the reader perhaps make up their own mind.
A judge's instructions to the juries are almost always confusing. It would have been boring reading. It would have been pages and pages and pages of reading. I'm not going to waste my time on that. The fact that the jury couldn't understand the instructions is what is important to me, and that they had to keep asking him what such and such a thing meant.
Do you feel, as it seemed to me, that in your book, these pieces are much more sensitive to the victim than to the defendant?
I don't think. I know. I am a victim's advocate. I think that the victim gets forgotten about in these trials, just the way that in the Menendez trial, Leslie Abramson...
She was one of the defending attorneys in that case.
She was the defending attorney of note. She dressed Eric and Lyle Menendez, who had shotgunned their parents to death with 16 shots. And she dressed them in pastel-colored Shetland sweaters and, you know, to make them look young and dear and sweet. And, you know, that's their right to do it, but it's my right to report on it.
In a sense, the entire book is an implicit criticism of the media simply because it isn't like what we usually read. What don't you like about how the media covers justice?
Well, I'm not criticizing how the media covers it. Newspaper coverage is very balanced. I don't balance my coverage. I take a stand. I believed Klaus von Bülow was guilty. I believed the Menendez brothers were guilty. I believed O.J. Simpson was guilty. I believe William Kennedy Smith was guilty. And I write from that point of view, like it or not. And I fortunately write for a magazine that allows me to take a stand.
You don't strive to be even-handed in your coverage, then?
Openly not. Openly not.
You want to correct what you see as a broader
inequality.
Well,
I mean, I have no embarrassment about that. I mean, I'm just sick of, all this, we have to balance it. If you say this, you've got to balance it with this person. I don't believe that. And I think that's why my writing on these cases is different from other people's.
What do you think about the way television handles trials?
Well, interesting. See, I'm all for televised trials. I think the American public has begun to understand the legal system through televised trials. It gets abused. That's the only problem. I mean, I cover the high-profile trials. I cover the trials of the rich and the famous. And some of these people, the Marsha Clarks, the Robert Shapiros, they became famous characters. They all change. They all begin to think they're these wildly important people. And an arrogance sets in. That's what I write about.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. I enjoyed this.
Dominic Dunn is the author of Justice, Crimes, Trials, and Punishments.
Coming up, turning litter into literature, and the rise of the media literacy movement, or how to smarten up the kids.
This is On the Media from National Public Radio. Welcome back to On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Sometimes you just find things. My daughter once found a shopping list in the aisle of a Sports Authority. It was a to-do list for a coming vacation. Snorkeling, golf, tennis, make love to Jennifer, spearfishing. Quite a busy itinerary that raised a million questions, not the least of which was,
Did poor Jennifer write this herself?
Found objects can be curious, even titillating, as a group of Chicagoans have discovered. They have published in an extremely limited edition the first issue of Found, a magazine that displays fascinating found notes and objects. Davy Rothbart is the publisher. Bob spoke to him recently and found something wholly unexpected himself.
Davy, welcome to On the Media.
Good to be here.
What's the most disturbing thing that you've uncovered?
A lot of notes have, you know, they're disturbing because somebody wants something so badly and they're not going to get it. There's a lot of notes from girls to boys, and what they say ultimately is, you know, I love you, why haven't I heard from you? And there's something kind of real sad about it, but beautiful. It's a little disturbing.
Now, there was one you found on a windshield.
Yeah, that was actually on the windshield of my own car, and I pulled it open. It said, Mario. Mario, why is your car parked here in front of her house? I hate you. I hate you. I hate you. You're a big liar. You said you had to work, but your car is here. I hate you. Amber. P.S. Page me later. Yeah, yeah. You know, that's what I like about found stuff is just it kind of gives you a window right into someone's innermost fears and desires. And I don't feel like it's too voyeuristic because it's anonymous also, you know. They're not going to be
exposed.
However,
for someone who happens upon his or her angry note or yearning note or what have you, you would forgive them for feeling a major invasion of privacy.
Well, sure. But, you know, once an item is left on the bus or otherwise lost, I kind of believe that it belongs to the world. I mean, if people don't want their embarrassing love letters published or their secret thoughts or nude pictures of their lovers, they hold on to them. I mean, it's crazy the stuff people find. I don't know why they can't keep them in a safe place in their room.
Now, one of the most fascinating things in your magazine is a short story about a man who makes a fateful decision to walk to work and crosses the Golden Gate Bridge and there finds someone who is about to leap to his death. Just a god-awful piece of writing. What makes it interesting, however, is that, is its provenance. Where did it come from?
Cotton Correctional Facility in Jackson, Michigan. It was found by another inmate. Found it in the classroom there.
And you printed it. But did you make any attempt to find out actually who the author was?
No, but the friend of mine who's in that prison, he was kind of thought he might know who it is because it says by D. Smith.
So you haven't gotten any permission from D. Smith to print his short story and found?
Right. I didn't really get permission to print too much of the stuff that's in the magazine, and I don't think that'll be a problem. There was one thing that's already caused a little bit of a stir. One secretary is going away on a trip or something, and she wants to leave instructions for her replacement how to coddle the boss while she's gone. She says, give him crushed ice, not cubes, for his cokes. Always a cup, never a straw. And all these other kind of tiny words of wisdom. I left the names on there, who it was from and who it was to, and I guess it was on the website too. The woman called me, kind of frantic, afraid that she might lose her job because of it. You know, I don't know. I'd say we didn't necessarily do anything wrong, but if that was the outcome, that's not what we would want to happen.
Is it possible that you're going to somehow be a prisoner of your success, that you're going to sell more and more, and all of a sudden lawyers are going to start knocking on your door talking about their clients' rights and how you violated them?
I guess I'm not too worried about being sued only because
I have no money.
Yeah, I have no money, and I'm not making any money on this.
I'm doing the arithmetic here. 800 copies, $5 a piece, that's $4,000. It's not going to be a cash cow for you, is it, Davy?
No, not at all. It's just a hobby. I love found things. I love these notes. I don't know. I guess I feel most alive when I'm glimpsing other people's lives.
How do you make a living?
Mostly what I've been doing the last few years is scalping tickets. You can pretty much do that anywhere. So
you're
where I am. A real low-grade one. And really, I think ticket scalpers are doing a community service. I like to think of it that way, not so much as a criminal.
What's your friend in prison for? What did he do?
Drugs. You know, Michigan's pretty conservative.
You wouldn't by any chance supplement your... I mean, it's not drug money that's behind this enterprise.
A little bit of everything. Why don't I just say that? You know,
you're an
whatever,
entrepreneur is what you're telling me.
Yeah, exactly.
Davy Rothbart is the publisher, though he calls himself the point guard of Found Magazine.
Are you media literate? Can you tell when and how you are manipulated by unseen media forces to want things, to tune in, and to pay attention? You soon will, if the newly formed Alliance for a Media Literate America has its way. It hopes to wise up consumers to the kind of tactics that can make one suddenly yearn for frosted oh goodness and marshmallow surprises. That is, if you didn't yearn for them already. But now some media literacy advocates are worried that corporate support will compromise the movement just as it's getting off the ground. On the Media's Paul Ingalls reports.
And they're trying to interweave them to make it look like the actor pilot is the real pilot.
In a darkened hotel ballroom in Austin, Texas, about 400 educators and professionals watch a big screen video that features people like themselves describing how important it is to help students critically analyze and create media messages.
The number one principle of media education is that media are not windows in the world, media are not mirrors of society, but carefully manufactured products.
We've got Abby, she's flipping through our Good Housekeeping.
The video shows teachers helping elementary to high school students deconstruct advertising to understand persuasion and marketing techniques.
So is it real or is it unrealistic? Convince me. Tell me what you think.
Students are also seen analyzing their own favorite films, TV, and music in search of value messages. And they're making their own media messages to learn how message makers choose what to put in and what to leave out. All this activity falls under the broad discipline known as media literacy, a growing field that's led to this night when a national membership organization called the Alliance for a Media Literate America, or AMLA, is formally born. Education consultant Faith Rogow is its president.
I have a vision of a world where every school teaches analysis and production in a fully integrated way in every curriculum area. That's going to happen.
To make it happen, the AMLA will help practitioners share techniques and resources and advocate for the cause. It's also considering a national awareness campaign featuring celebrities. Much like the Got Milk campaign, the ad's aim would be to get the words media literacy on the lips of all Americans, most of whom would likely have a hard time defining it today. Naturally, all of this will cost a lot of money. The Austin conference alone costs around $85,000, most of it paid by media companies, among them AOL Time Warner Foundation, which pitched in $25,000. For some conference attendees, media companies sponsoring media literacy represents a problem.
You don't go out and get sponsors who you might be critical of in the very nature of doing your job.
Jim Medrock is a media activist from Alabama, campaigning to keep commercial interests out of the schools. Get corporate funding, he says, but get it somewhere else.
You should never take any money from Time Warner, because then you at least give the perception that there's undue influence there, or that you're withholding criticism.
AMLA board members say their bylaws ensure that a media sponsor wouldn't influence any stance the board might take. Board member Renee Hobbs, a professor at Babson College outside Boston, favors partnering with media corporations. She's even developed media literacy materials under contract with Channel One, the controversial in-school sponsored news program owned by AOL Time Warner. Hobbs says the AMLA won't be able to get the media literacy message into the mainstream without the support of big media.
Those folks have come to us and said, help me find a way for my company to support you. And we treasure those relationships because those are people in media companies who are parents and citizens too, who are vitally concerned about bringing these skills to kids just the same way we are. They just happen to be in different places.
It's just the height of naivete to say, well, somebody really friendly and concerned called me from these corporations. I can tell you that's called public relations.
John Stauber runs the nonprofit Center for Media and Democracy, which tracks efforts by corporations to manage public perception and the news media.
Corporations know how to defeat movements for democracy, social justice, public education, public health. And I don't think it's just this movement. This is happening in the environmental movement, the consumer movement, the family farm movement.
But David Eisner, senior vice president of the AOL Time Warner Foundation, says his company's goal is not to undermine the media literacy movement, but to strengthen it.
There will be a lot of issues that we discuss, from how non-commercial content finds its way onto the internet, to how we can make sure that cable is a more open environment, to how consumers can be best educated about what content is most suited for them. The AMLA, as they already seem to, understand that they can help us figure out some of these key and very complex issues.
They want 72 million kids media literate.
AMLA board member Renee Hobbs.
Now, they want it for different reasons maybe than I do, but they share the vision.
Hobbs hopes to convince her colleagues that a firewall can be maintained between the entities and that media company sponsorship of media literacy won't damage the movement's credibility. Others fear this debate is just the start of a permanent split in the movement, just as it readies itself for prime time. For On the Media, I'm Paul Ingalls.
The Peterson's Guide to Summer Opportunities lists the following programs available to curious students: archaeology, mountain climbing, foreign and public affairs, caring for chimpanzees, medicinal plants of Kenya, the carnivores of Madagascar, and field hockey. But what about media literacy? Don't worry. A summer camp in Fairfield, Connecticut called Media Mania has just ended its two-week program. OTM's producer-at-large Mike Pesca was there.
As summer approached, you can imagine the parents of the middle school students enrolled in Media Mania pleading, "Will you get out of the house and watch some TV already?" But the students at Media Mania are doing more than watching TV, though they are doing that. They're also making TV.
Imagine this is the camera on its secured tripod, right? Now, what happens is this.
According to Diane Samples, who runs the program, hands-on time with video equipment is the main draw, and the best way to really learn how the media work.
The camera stays with
the
floor.
So while it's going like this, the camera is staying.
Yep.
I get it.
Yep. At Media Mania Camp, there are lessons on how teen magazines convince girls to diet, how hamburgers and fast food commercials are propped up with toothpicks and all the meat pushed to the front, and how computers can manipulate images so that what you see isn't always what you get. Samples is looking to spread the gospel across the land.
Once they get through their video project and they have had to decide the camera angle, the lighting, how long the shot is, what graphics are going to go along with it. Once they've had to make all those decisions, then they start to get the notion that everything that they watch, there's these invisible people somewhere, and they begin to understand how much power those people have.
In Canada, every provincial government mandates media literacy courses, and advertising aimed at children is closely regulated. A lot of the commercials on American TV would be banned in Canada. As a result, Canadian advertisers are forced to regard children as something more than prey.
My perspective is that media literacy is so important that it is something that should be mass marketed.
Max Veliket advises marketers through his Toronto-based firm, Youthography.
It's helping to give rise to maybe a more empowered young person, a young person who understands business a little bit more, who's willing to look at advertising, look at current culture, look at marketing, and think about it in a more formal fashion. We've been hearing young people say, I don't think that brand is targeted to me. I mean, it's amazing when you hear a young person talk in a language like that because it means they're really starting to get and understand marketing.
And they probably use impact as a verb. But more importantly, there's a whole new generation of Canadians that rejects a brand like Nike despite the slick commercials and, to a lesser extent, quality footwear. Veliket says that Nike's association with sweatshops hurt the company's image among teens steeped in media literacy.
I think that what it means is that you've got to be more authentic. I think that what it means is that you have to have made sure to actually speak to young people. I think it is making it easier to reject certain brands out of hand.
Back in the classroom in Connecticut, Diane Samples teaches the Media Mania campers about the pernicious effects of tobacco advertising.
The tobacco company thought men won't smoke a cigarette that's marketed only to women, but women will smoke a cigarette that's marketed men, so
speaking of media manipulation, this isn't an actual lesson. It's a restaging of the previous day's lesson for the benefit of a U.S. News and World Report photographer who wants to shoot in good light. That's his camera you hear.
Okay, this is Virginia Slims and Michaela.
If nothing else, Samples is able to draw upon her background in corporate PR to get press attention for the program. She also has the kids' attention.
Congratulations. How do you feel? I gotta pay.
Clips from Forrest Gump and a display of the Time magazine cover that darkened OJ's mugshot serve as examples in a lesson on digitally altered images. It seems this group of mini McLuhans may be learning their lesson too well. I asked a group how many photos in, say, the New York Times were digitally altered. The lowest estimate I got was half. half of all photographs in the New York Times were faked. A week after the program ended, I called camper Michaela Walsh and asked her again about the prevalence of digitally altered photographs.
Well, I think it goes on a lot because they can change basically anything with computers and technology. So I think most pictures that we look at in magazines or newspapers are digitally changed.
The camp taught that a newspaper can alter photographs. It didn't teach that doing so would violate the standards and practices of most legitimate news organizations. That's the difference between what you get from an abbreviated summer program and a year-long class. But getting media literacy as part of the standard curricula of schools may be a tall order. Plain old literacy is elusive enough. Also, Canada, Australia, and the other countries where media literacy is taught have far different political cultures. Youthography President Max Villiquet.
Our institutions and our government tend to be more to the left than institutions and government in the States. And that's a huge difference for us. It's not in the kids who are consuming this stuff. It's in the adults who are determining how this is going to happen.
So, will media literacy, like the metric system in professional soccer, become one of those nearly universal ideas that never really gets off the ground in America? Actually, the most outspoken American politician on all things media, Connecticut Senator Joseph Lieberman, supports media literacy. He even supports putting some money behind it. Lieberman Communication Director Dan Gerstein.
At this point, we are looking at some possibilities of getting some funding from the entertainment industry to establish some pilot programs in different parts of the country, you know, hopefully expand funding for it, both through public education institutions, but also through private sources.
Teaching media literacy in schools gets the endorsement of camper Michaela Walsh.
I think, in my opinion, that what we learned at camp is really important because it tells us, like, what they're trying to do and how they're trying to sell us.
Can you imagine a day when smoking in the bathroom won't get you suspended, it will get you an F for naivete? When wearing name-brand sneakers is the source of schoolyard taunts? How about themeless proms to avoid charges of branding? Sound far-fetched? That's because changing the content of what children learn in school is no easier than changing what they learn everywhere else. For On the Media, I'm Mike Pesca.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Janine Price and Katya Rogers, engineered by Irene Trudell, and edited by Brooke. We had help from Sean Landis, Andy Lancet, and John Keefe.
Mike Pesca is our producer at large, Arun Roth, our senior producer, and Dean Capello, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and get free transcripts at onthemedia.org and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from National Public Radio. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Funding for On the Media is provided by the Ford Foundation, the Florence and John Schumann Foundation, the Bidell Foundation, the John T. and James L. Knight Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This program is a production of WNYC Radio New York. This is NPR, National Public Radio.